the number, but the house was gone, evidently razed to make way for expanding campus facilities. The remaining houses on the street tended to be elongated one-story boxes sheathed in dark red asphalt siding. Depressing. I couldn't imagine how Laddie'd been catapulted from these grim beginnings to her current wealth. Had she been married before? In those days, a rich husband was the obvious means by which a woman could elevate her social standing and improve her prospects. She certainly must have been eager to bail herself out of this. While I was still in range of the central city, I located the Jefferson County Clerk's Office in the courthouse between 5th and 6th Streets on West Jefferson. The fellow at the desk couldn't have been more helpful when I told him what I needed. The marriage certificate for Darlene Ledestro and Mark Bethel, whom I believed had been married in the summer of 1965. I couldn't give him the exact date, but I was remembering the line I'd picked up from Mark's secretary, Judy, who told me he'd enlisted in the Army right after his college graduation. What would have been more natural than to marry Laddie that summer before he went overseas? I was also operating on the theory that Laddie, a.k.a. Darlene Ledestro, was an obvious choice for one of Duncan's interviews. She was young, she was lovely, she was local. She would have been easy to approach since they lived in the same town and he'd known her for years. Duncan's press credentials were dated September 10th, 1965. If he'd talked to Laddie at all, it was probably sometime between her marriage, Mark's departure, and his own soon after. 15 minutes later, I experienced one of those exhilarating moments of satisfaction when, sure enough, the clerk found the record of the marriage certificate. "Oh, wow, this is great. Isn't this amazing?" I said. The clerk's look was jaded. "I'm completely stunned." I laughed. "Well, I like being right, especially when I'm flying by the seat of my pants." He leaned on the counter, his chin on his hand, looking on while I took out my cards and jotted down the information embedded in the form. The license was issued on June 3, 1965. Assuming it was good for 30 days, the wedding must have taken place within the month. Darlene Ledestro, age 22, and working as a bookkeeper, was the daughter of Harold and Millicent Ledestro and resided at the address listed in the 1961 telephone book. Mark Charles Bethel, age 23, occupation U.S. Army, was the son of Vernon and Shirley Bethel, with an address on Trevilian Way. Neither the bride nor the groom had been previously married. Idly, the clerk said, "You know who he is, don't you?" I looked up at him with interest. "Who, Mark Bethel?" "No, Ledestro." "I don't know a thing about him. What's the story on him?" "He was awarded the patent for some kind of widget used on the Mercury space flights."
"And that's how he made his money?"
"Sure. He's famous around here. Self-taught, eccentric. He didn't even have a connection to the aerospace industry. He just worked on his own. I saw a picture of him once. He looked like a pointy-headed geek. He'd been tinkering all his life without making a dime. In hock up to here, living in a dump. Everybody wrote him off as a nut. And then he comes along and aces out McDonnell Douglas for the rights to this thing. He died a rich man. I mean, very, very rich."
"Well, I'll be darned," I said. "What was it, the thing he patented?"
"Some doodad, who knows. I heard it's in use to this day. The world is full of guys who design gizmos they never get credit for. Ledestro hired a patent attorney and took the big boys down."
"Incredible."
"His daughter sure lucked out. I hear she lives in California now on some fancy estate," he said. He pointed to the license. "You want a copy of that?"
"How much?"
$2 for regular, $5 for certified."
"Regular's fine," I said.
I drove from Jefferson to 3rd, then hung a left on Broadway, driving east until it angled into Bardstown Road. I followed Bardstown Road through an area of town known as the Highlands. Once on Trevilian, I found the house where the Bethels had lived. The white frame house looked comfortable, not large, but well-maintained in a solid middle-class neighborhood, certainly superior to the one where Laddie'd grown up. I parked in front of the house, traversed the long, sloping walk, and climbed the stairs to the porch.
No one was home, but a simple check of the mailbox revealed that a family named Pointer now occupied the house. This was Donna Reed country. Green shutters on the windows, pansies in the flower boxes, a tricycle on the sidewalk, and a dog bone lying in the yard. All the window panes sparkled and the shrubs were trimmed. As I looked on, a lean gray cat picked her way carefully across the newly cut lawn. I returned to the car where I sat and studied my map. Gauging the proximity of schools in the area, I decided Mark probably attended Highland Junior High and then Atherton or St. Xavier, the Catholic high school on Broadway. He might have gone to private school. I wasn't sure about that. But he struck me as the sort who'd take pride in his public school roots. Now what? I leafed through the pages I'd assembled, letting my mind wander. I'd added a number of dots, but I still couldn't see all the lines connecting them. Duncan Oak seemed pivotal. I sensed his presence like the hub of an enormous wheel. I could trace the hometown relationship between him and Benny Quintero. Contemporaries, two high school athletes had played the same positions on opposing football teams, and their paths had crossed years later on the bloody soil of Viadrang. After that, Duncan Oaks had vanished. But Quintero had survived, keeping Duncan's dog tags, his press credentials, and a snapshot. I could also tie Duncan Oaks to Laddie Bethel, born Darlene Ledestro, who'd attended high school with him. And here's where the machinations became more intricate. Laddie was now married to the attorney who'd represented my ex-husband, a suspect in Benny Quintero's beating death 7 years later. I started the car and headed back to my motel. Even without the links, a picture was forming, crude and unfocused, but one that Mickey must have seen as well. The problem was I had no proof a crime had been committed all those years ago, let alone that it had sparked such tragic consequences in the here and now. It simply stood to reason some combination of events had resulted in the killing of Benny Quintero and the shooting of Mickey Magruder. I had to fashion a story that encompassed all the players and made sense of their fates. If life is a play, then there's a logical explanation, an underlying tale that pulls the whole of it together, however clouded it first appears. Before my plane the next morning, I put in a call to Porter Yount, asking if he could lay his hands on the columns Duncan Oaks wrote before he went to Vietnam. Much hemming and hawing, but he said he'd see what he could do. I gave him my address and a great big telephone kiss, telling him to take care. I'd be in touch with him. The flight home was uneventful, though it took up most of the day. Louisville to Tulsa, Tulsa to Santa Fe, Santa Fe to Los Angeles, where I shuttled to the motel, picked up my VW, and drove the 90 minutes home. Between the actual hours in the air, the wait between planes, and the commute at the end, I arrived in Santa Teresa at 4:30 p.m. I was feeling irritable, tired, hungry, flat-haired, oily-faced. I was also dehydrated from all the nuts I'd eaten in lieu of meals that day. I had to slap myself around some to keep from whining out loud. The minute I got home, I sat down at my desk and removed Mark Bethel's curriculum vitae from the bottom drawer where I'd tucked it Saturday. On the front page, he'd listed his date and place of birth as Dayton, Ohio, August 1st, 1942. He graduated with a BA from the University of Kentucky in 1965. Under military experience, he'd listed U.S. Army, modestly omitting mention of his Purple Heart. I'd called Judy in the morning, my palate smeared with peanut butter, pretending to be a journalist so I could pin that down. If Mark had been at Viadrang, I'd be one step closer to completing the picture, which was almost done. I stripped, showered, and shampooed my hair. I brushed my teeth, got dressed again, and trotted down the spiral stairs. My first thought was to have a conversation with Carlin Duffy, conveying a condensed version of what I'd learned in Louisville, though at this point I still didn't know quite what to make of it. I'd restrict myself to the facts, leaving out the speculations and suppositions I was still playing with. The contact was largely a courtesy on my part. He hadn't hired me, he wasn't paying me, and I didn't feel I owed him an explanation. I was hoping, however, that he'd have something to contribute, Some piece of the puzzle he hadn't thought to share. More to the point, I remembered Duffy's rage and frustration the night he'd appeared at Mickey's. I didn't relish a repeat performance, and this was my way of protecting myself. Duffy's brother had died, and he had his stake in the matter. I headed out to the nursery where I found a parking slot in front of the gardening center. I prayed Duffy was on the premises instead of at the honky-tonk. The bar was open at this hour, but I didn't dare go back. I thought I'd better keep my distance in case Tim and Scotty realized it was me who blew the whistle on them. It was close to 5:30, still light out, and I made my way easily along the aisles. I could see the roof line of the shed at the rear of the lot, and I mentally marked my route. There was no direct path, and I angled back and forth between the crated trees. When I reached the shed, I saw a compact yellow forklift parked in the entrance. Several large bags of mulch were stacked on the forks in front. Tall and boxy, the vehicle was an overblown version of the Tonka toys I'd played with when I was six. The phase had been short-lived, tucked somewhere between Legos and the demise of the baby doll I'd flattened with my trike. I moved into the shed, pushing aside the blanket Duffy'd hung to eliminate drafts. He had passed out, lying on his cot, his shoes off. His mouth hung open and his snores filled the enclosure with bourbon fumes. He cradled an empty pint of Early Times against his chest. One sock was pulled half off and his bare heel was exposed. He looked absurdly young for a fellow who'd spent half his life in jail. I thought, shit. I found a blanket and tossed it over him, and then placed the dog tags, the press pass, a snapshot and a note on the crate where he'd see it when he woke. The note said I'd be in touch the next day and fill him in on the trip. I backed out of the shed, leaving him to sleep off his drunken state. I walked back to the car, thinking how often I identified with guys like him. As crude as he was with his racist comments, his tortured grammar, and his attitude toward crime, I understood his yearning. How liberating it was when you defied authority, flaunted convention, ignoring ordinary standards of moral decency. I knew my own ambivalence. On the one hand, I was a true law and order type, prissy in my judgment, outraged at those who violated the doctrines of honesty and fair play. On the other hand, I'd been known to lie through my teeth, eavesdrop, pick locks, or simply break into people's houses, where I snooped through their possessions and took anything I wanted. It wasn't nice, but I savored every single minute of my bad girl behavior. Later, I'd feel guilty, but still, I couldn't resist. I was split down the middle, my good angel sitting on one shoulder, Lucifer perched on the other. Duffy's struggle was the same, and while he leaned in one direction, I usually leaned in the other, searching for justice in the heart of anarchy. This was the bottom line, as far as I was concerned. If the bad guys don't play by the rules, why should the good guys have to? I drove back into town. It was now 5:50, and I was starving, of course, so I made a quick detour. I pulled up to the drive-in window at McDonald's and asked for a QP with cheese, a large order of fries, and a Coke to go. I was fairly humming with excitement as I waited for my bag of goodies. I could go back to my apartment and change into my jammies, then curl up on the couch where I'd watch junk TV while I ate my junk food. Driving home, the car smelled divine, like a mobile microwave oven. I found a great parking place, locked the car, and let myself in through the squeaking gate. I rounded the corner, all a-twitter at the notion of the pleasures to come. I stopped dead. Detectives Class and Aldo were standing on my front porch. This was a replay of our earlier encounter. Same guys in their late 30s, the one dark, the other fair, same sports coats. Class carried the briefcase just as he had before. John Aldo chewed gum. He'd had his dark hair trimmed short, but his eyebrows still met like a hedge across the bridge of his nose. I longed to fall on him with a pair of tweezers and pluck him bald. I said, "Well, what do you want?" Detective Class seemed amused. "Now, that was different." "Be nice. We drove all the way up here to have a chat with you. I walked past him with my keys and unlocked the door. Detective Class wore a hair product that smelled like a high school chemistry experiment. The two followed me in. I dropped my shoulder bag on the floor next to my desk, taking a moment to check my answering machine. No messages. I held up my McDonald's bag, the contents getting colder by the minute, as were my hopes. I gotta eat first. I'm half dead. Have at it. I crossed to the kitchen, moving around the counter to the refrigerator. I took out a chilled bottle of Chardonnay and then sorted through the junk drawer until I found the opener. You want wine? I'm having some. You might as well join me. The two exchanged a look. It was probably against regulations, but they must have thought I'd be easier to get along with if I were all liquored up. We'd appreciate that. Thanks, Class said. I handed him the wine bottle and the opener, and he got to work while I set out three glasses and a paper plate. I dumped the fries out of the carton and fetched the ketchup bottle from the cabinet. Help yourself, I said. Detective Class poured the wine, and we stood there eating lukewarm French fries with our fingers. They were completely limp by now, and we dropped them in our beaks like a trio of birdies eating albino worms. Ever gracious, I cut the QP into three equal parts, and we gulped those down, too. After supper, we walked the six steps into the living room. This time, I took the couch and let them settle into my director's chairs. I noticed Detective Class kept his briefcase close at hand as he had before. I knew he had a tape recorder in there, and it made me want to lean down and address all my comments into the opening. So now what? I said, crossing my arms against my chest. Detective Aldo smiled.
We have some news we thought you might want to hear firsthand. We picked up a partial print on the Smith & Wesson and matched it to some prints that showed up in Magruder's place.
Class said, You remember a gray metal box concealed in the bottom of a chair? I could feel my mouth go dry.
Sure.
No sound. I cleared my throat and tried again.
Sure. We got a real nice set on the inner rim of the lid, like someone pulled it open with their fingertips.
I was going to call his attention to the matter of subject-pronoun agreement, but I held my tongue. Instead, I said, Who? Was that an owl I heard? Aldo spoke up again, clearly enjoying himself.
Mark Bethels.
I stared at him, blinking. You're kidding. You gotta be kidding me, I said.
He went in there Sunday night and left prints everywhere.
That's great. I love it. Good for him, I said.
We're not sure what he was looking for.
I held a hand up. I can tell you that, I said. I gave them a hasty summary of the work I'd done, including the discovery of Duncan Oak's credentials and Mickey's jacket lining. I can't believe he was dumb enough to leave his fingerprints. Has the man lost his mind?
He's getting desperate, Class said. He probably saw the print dust on all the surfaces and figured we were done.
You dusted again?
Yep. Tuesday morning, Aldo said.
But why? What possessed you?
We got a call from Cordia Hatfield. She'd seen lights on Sunday night. You swore it wasn't you, so she suspected it was him, Class said.
But how'd he get in?
With the key she'd given him. He'd stopped by last week and introduced himself as Magruder's attorney. He said he'd be paying Mickey's bills till he was on his feet, and he was hoping to pick up insurance policies and bank deposit slips. She gave him a key. Of course, he returned it later, but probably not before he'd had a copy made for himself, Class said.
Detective Aldo spoke up.
I don't think the computer would have caught the match without the fresh set he left. Of course, we wasted a lot of time eliminating yours.
I could feel my cheeks heat. Oh, sorry about that. Aldo wagged his finger, but he didn't seem that mad.
Class said, We can also place Bethel in the area at the time of the shooting.
You guys have been busy. How'd you do that?
Class was clearly pleased with himself. On the 13th, Bethel was in Los Angeles for a TV appearance. The taping finished at 10 o'clock. He checked into the Four Seasons on a late arrival and then went out again, returning in the early hours of the 14th. He might have slipped in unnoticed, but as it happened, the valet car park was a supporter and recognized his face.
Tell you what else, Detective Aldo said. We got somebody saw them together that night.
No.
Oh, yes. We went through a bunch of matchbooks Magruder kept at a fishbowl. We found 7 from a dive on Wilshire near offices for Pacific Coast Security. A gal at the bar remembered seeing them.
Detective Aldo sat back, the wood and canvas chair creaking under his weight.
What about you? What'd you pick up back east? Your landlord told us you made a trip to Louisville.
Well, that's right. I just got back today.
Learn anything?
Actually, I did. I'm just piecing this together, so I can't be sure. But here's what I know. Laddie Bethel went to high school in Louisville with a guy named Duncan Oakes. They were the king and queen of the prom in 61, the year they graduated. At some point, Laddie met Mark. They married in the summer of 1965 after he graduated from college. Mark enlisted in the Army right around the time Duncan Oakes was doing a series for the Louisville Tribune. I suspect Mark went to Vietnam, but I haven't pinned that down.
We can help on that. He did. We have not been exactly idle here.
Class reached into his briefcase and removed a manila folder, which he opened, leafing through the contents.
Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry.
Well, great, I said. I don't have a clue how it ties in, but maybe we'll figure that out. At any rate, Duncan had an idea for a series and began interviewing the soldiers' wives. His intention was to talk about the war from their differing perspectives, the one off at war, the other one stuck on the home front. I think Duncan and Laddie had a brief affair. Pure conjecture on my part. Within weeks, Oakes went to Vietnam. He and Mark must have crossed paths. In fact, Oakes probably sought him out for the second half of the interview.
And?
That's as far as I can take it, I said, shrugging.
Aldo said, maybe Mark fragged him.
Fragged? What's that?
You know, offed, eliminated, killed him deader than a doornail. I mean, how hard could it be with all those bullets flying? It's not like the medics run ballistics tests.
I thought about it for a moment. That's probably not a bad idea, especially if Mark found out about the relationship between Duncan and his wife.
Assuming there was one, Class said.
Well, yeah.
Anyway, go on. Sorry for the interruption.
I start faltering here and resort to waving hands. I mean, I can put some of this together, but I don't have proof. Benny Quintero was another Louisville boy. I know Duncan and Benny were at Iadrang together because I saw a picture of the two of them. According to my information, Duncan Oakes was wounded by Mark, friendly fire, the NVA. We're never going to know that, so we might as well skip that part. In any event, he was loaded on a chopper filled with the wounded and the dead. By the time the chopper landed, he disappeared without a trace.
Aldo spoke up. Maybe Mark's on the chopper and shoves him out the door. The guy falls, what, 6 to 1,200 feet, landing in the thick of the jungle? Trust me, in 2 weeks there's nothing left but bones. From what you say, Oakes wasn't even in the army, so it's perfect. Who gives a shit about a fucking journalist?
I said, right. The point is, I think Benny knew, and that's why he held on to Duncan's ID. Again, I don't have proof, but it does make sense. Maybe he thought of a way to turn a profit on the deal, Class said.
What happened to Benny?
He was wounded by sniper fire and ended up with a plate in his head. In 1971, he came out to California, that much we know. Mickey and Benny got in a shoving match that didn't come to much. No blows were struck. A day later, someone beat Benny senseless and he ended up dead. I went on to detail Mickey's history of misbehavior and why he'd looked good for the beating when internal affairs stepped in. Class said,
I don't see the relevance.
Mark was Mickey's attorney. He's the one who advised him to leave the department to avoid questioning.
Got it.
Aldo leaned forward.
Speaking of which, how'd Bethel end up with your Smith & Wesson? That seems like a trick.
I think Mickey sold it to him. I have a record of a deposit in March for $200. Mark told me Mickey called and asked for money. I know Mickey better than that. I know he'd hoarded a stash of gold coins and bills, but that was probably not something he would have dipped into. He sold his car about then, and he was probably offloading his possessions, trying to make ends meet. The minute Mark bought the gun, he must have seen his way clear, because it was on that same trip he made the phone call from Mickey's apartment to my machine. All he had to do was distract Mickey's attention, dial the number, and let the tape run on when my machine picked up.
What if you'd been there?
Sorry, wrong number, and he tries the call later. He knew Mickey and Duffy were thick as thieves by then. Whatever his faults, Mickey's a hell of a detective. Mark must have known it was only a matter of time. He had a gun registered to me. He'd established a connection to me on Mickey's telephone bill. I'd be implicated anyway as soon as the gun registration came to light.
Aldo snorted. Fucking devious.
Class rubbed his hands together, then stretched his arms out in front of him, his fingers laced with the palms turned outward until I heard his knuckles crack.
Well, boys and girls, I've enjoyed the bedtime stories. Too bad none of this'll fly in court. Oh, yeah, which brings us to the next step, Aldo said, chiming in on cue. Shall I tell her the plan?
I said, you know, I don't like this. It sounds rehearsed.
Exactly, Class said. So here's what we thought. Forget Vietnam. We're never going to get him for whacking Duncan Oaks. No weapons, no witnesses.
Aldo said,
Quintero's another one. I mean, even if you prove it, the best you can hope for is a manslaughter bust, which is strictly bullshit.
I said, which brings us to Mickey.
And to you, Class said.
He reached in his briefcase and pulled out the tape recorder. He held it so I could see. I said, I knew that was in there.
But did you know how well it works?
He pressed rewind and then play, producing a clear, unobstructed recording of the conversation we'd just had.
We figure you can put this in your bag, trot yourself off to Bethel's, and maybe help us out.
You have an eavesdropping warrant?
No, we don't.
Isn't that illegal? I thought you needed a court order. Whatever happened to the Fourth Amendment? This from Kinsey Milhone, upholder of the Constitution.
You'd be doing a consent recording. It's done all the time by informants and undercover cops. As long as you're only taping comments someone makes to you, the court doesn't have a problem. Worst case scenario, assuming what you get is juicy, you use the tape to refresh your own memory when you testify in court.
Now I'm testifying in court?
If Mickey dies, you do, right?
I could feel my attention shift from Aldo to Class, who said,
Look at it this way. We're building a case. We gotta have something for the DA.
Aldo leaned forward.
That's what we're in business to do. Get this cocksucker nailed, if you'll excuse my Greek.
And Mark won't guess what I'm up to. He's not a fool, I said.
He's Mickey's attorney. You're back from Kentucky with a shitload of information, and you're filling him in. How can he resist? He wants to know what you know so he can measure the depth of the shit he's in. Of course, if he figures you're onto him, he'll want to pop you next.
Thanks. That helps. Now I'm really feeling good about all this.
Come on, it's no sweat. He's not going to do it in his own living room.
Aldo moved to the phone, holding the receiver out.
Give him a call.
Right now?
Sure, why not? Tell him you have some stuff you want to talk to him about.
Yeah, I said cautiously. And then what?
We haven't made that part up yet.
The Bethels estate was on the outer edges of Montebello, perched on a bluff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. I'd spoken to Laddie on the phone, and she'd given me directions to the house on Savannah Lane. Mark was out, but she said he'd be returning shortly. It worried me she hadn't voiced greater surprise or curiosity about the reason for my call. I'd mentioned the trip to Louisville, that I had something to discuss, preferably with the two of them, though I'd certainly value the opportunity to talk to her alone first. If she was alarmed about such a conversation, she gave no indication. At 7 o'clock on the dot, I pulled in at the gate. Detectives Class and Aldo had followed me in their car, and they were parked in a grove of eucalyptus trees about 100 yards off. I had the tape recorder in my bag, but I wasn't wired for sound, so there was no way they could monitor the conversation once I was inside the house. No one, meaning them, seemed to think this would present a problem, since I'd be in the Bethels' home with other people, meaning servants, on the premises. Our plan, if that's what you want to call it, was for them to hover on the sidelines, falling in behind me when I left the estate. Then we'd go back to my place, listen to the tape, and see if what we'd picked up constituted probable cause. If so, we'd find a judge who could sign a warrant for Mark's arrest on charges of assault with a deadly weapon and attempted murder in the shooting of Mickey Magruder. If not, we'd move to Plan B, on which we'd never quite agreed. On reflection, even Plan A seemed a bit half-assed. But I was there at the gate, and I'd already pressed the button. I expected to hear someone on the intercom asking for my name. Instead, there was silence. The gate simply swung open, allowing me entrance. I waved to the boys and put the car in gear. The driveway was long and curved to the left. The land on either side was barren except for the grasses bending under the offshore winds. Occasionally, a tree broke the line of the horizon, a stark silhouette against the milder dark of the sky. I could see the lighted windows of the house, dazzling yellow and white, set in the bulky block of dark stone. I parked out in front on an enormous apron of gravel. I shut off the engine and sat taking in the sight of the house through the driver's side window. The structure was curiously reminiscent of Duncan Oakes's house in Louisville. Despite the appearance of age, I knew construction had been completed only 5 years before, which might explain the absence of mature trees. The exterior was stone and stucco. Landscape lights washed the facade with its glaze of dusky pink, underlaid with brown. In theory, the style was Mediterranean or Italianate, one of those bastard forms that Californians tend to imitate, but the arches above the windows seemed remarkably similar to their Kentucky counterpart. The front door was recessed, sheltered in a portico flanked by fluted columns. Even the balustrade was kindred in design. Was Laddie conscious of what she'd done, or had she mimicked Duncan's house inadvertently? What is it that prompts us to reenact our unresolved issues? We revisit our wounds, reproducing the past in hopes that this time we can make the ending turn out right. The carriage lights on either side of the door came on. Reluctantly, I reached for my bag. I'd left the zippered compartment open, the tape recorder in easy range of my hand. I emerged from the car, crunched my way across the parking pad, and climbed the low front steps. Laddie opened the door before I had time to ring the bell.
Hello, Kinsey. How nice of you to drive all the way out here. I take it you had no trouble finding the place.
Not at all. It's beautiful.
We like it, she said mildly. Can I take your jacket?
Oh, this is fine for now. It's cold. She closed the door behind me.
Come on into the living room. I've got a nice fire burning. Will you have a drink? I'm having wine, she said.
She was already walking toward the living room, her heels clicking smartly against the highly polished limestone floors. I followed her, saying, I better not, but thanks. I had wine with dinner, and that's my limit. We stepped down into the living room with its 12-foot coffered ceiling. One entire wall of French doors looked onto a patio. The room was surprisingly light, done in shades of cream. The 20-by-24-foot area rug, the walls, the three plump matching love seats arranged near the fireplace. There were touches of black in the throw pillows and lampshades. Boston ferns providing spots of green here and there. Maybe I could snitch some ideas for my spacious abode. The coffee table was a square of 3/4-inch glass, resting on three enormous polished brass spheres. A second wine glass sat near a bottle of Chardonnay in an insulated cooler. Laddie'd made quite a dent for someone drinking by herself. I flicked on the tape recorder during the momentary lull as she picked up her wine glass and settled on one of the sofas that flanked the fireplace. The hearth was glossy black granite that reflected the blaze. Really, I was taking notes. I had to have one of those. I sat down opposite her, wondering how to begin. These transitions can be awkward, especially when you're trying to shift the discussion from niceties to the subject of murder. She said, "What were you doing in Louisville? We used to go for the Derby, but it's been ages." A maid came to the door.
I left Mr. Bethel's plate in the warming oven. Will there be anything else?
No, dear, that's fine. We'll see you in the morning.
Yes, ma'am, the woman said, and then withdrew. I said, actually, I went to Louisville on a research trip. Do you remember Benny Quintero, the fellow who was killed here a few years ago?
Of course. Mark represented Mickey.
Well, as it happens, Benny was from Louisville. He went to Manual the same time you were at Louisville Mail High. Her lips parted in expectation.
What kind of research was this? I can't imagine.
I keep thinking there's a connection between Benny Quintero's death and Mickey's being shot last week. Laddie's frown was delicate.
That's quite a leap.
Not really, I said. Though it does seem odd. Here, the four of you come from the same hometown.
Four?
Sure. You, Mark, Benny, and Duncan Oakes. You remember Duncan, I said.
Of course, but he's been gone for years.
My point exactly, I said. Gee, this was going better than I'd thought. During his stint in Vietnam, Mark was at Ia Drang, right?
You'd have to verify that with him, but I believe so.
Turns out Benny was there, too.
I guess I'm not following. What does any of this have to do with my graduating from Mail?
Let me back up a step. Didn't Duncan Oakes interview you for the Louisville Tribune? She said,
Kinsey, what is this? I don't mean to be rude, but you're skipping back and forth, and I'm confused. I really don't see the relevance.
Just hear me out, I said. Duncan was doing a series for the local paper. He interviewed army wives like you who'd been left behind, you know, talking about the war from their perspective. His idea was to tell the same story through the eyes of the husbands off fighting in Vietnam. Laddie shook her head, shrugging.
I guess I'll have to take your word for it.
At any rate, he did talk to you. She took a sip of wine.
It's possible I don't remember.
Don't worry about the date. I've asked his editor to send a copy of the article. We can pin it down from that. Anyway, Duncan's editor says he flew to Vietnam in September of 65. He ran into Mark and Benny at Ia Drang, which was where Duncan disappeared. I was doling out pure theory, but I noticed she'd stopped offering much in the way of objections. 7 years later, Benny shows up in Santa Teresa with Duncan Oakes's ID. The next thing you know, Benny's been murdered. You see the link?
Benny wasn't murdered. You're overstating the situation. As I remember it, Benny had a subdural hematoma, and his death was the result of an arterial bleed. Given the nature of his injury, it could have happened any time. Even the coroner's report said that.
Really? Well, you're probably right. You have quite a memory for detail, I said.
Mark and I discussed it at the time. I suppose it stuck in my mind.
Mickey's another link. He went off to Louisville on Thursday, May 8th. He came back on Monday, and in the wee hours of Wednesday morning, he was shot.
Laddie's smile was thin. Not to sound superior, but you're committing what's called a post hoc fallacy. Just because one event follows another doesn't mean there's a cause and effect relationship.
I see. In other words, just because Benny knew something doesn't mean he died for it.
Is this what you wanted to discuss with Mark?
In part.
Then let's leave that for a moment. I'm sure it's more appropriate to wait till he comes in.
I said, fine with me. Could we talk about your relationship with Duncan?
I'd hardly call it a relationship. I knew him, of course. We went all through school together.
Were you pals, confidants? Boyfriend, girlfriend?
We were friends, that's all.
There was never anything between us, if that's what you're getting at. Actually, it is, I said. I thought since you were the king and queen of the senior prom, you might have been sweet on each other.
Laddie smiled, her composure restored.
This was something she'd thought about. Her version of the story was pre-assembled and pre-packaged.
Duncan wasn't interested in me romantically, nor I in him.
Too bad, he looked cute.
He was cute. He was also extremely narcissistic, which I found obnoxious.
There's nothing worse than a 17-year-old kid who thinks he's hot stuff.
You don't think he was charismatic?
He thought he was, she said.
I thought he was conceited. Nice, funny, but such a snob.
What about your father?
She looked at me askance.
My father? What's he have to do with this?
This is peripheral and probably none of my business.
None of this is your business, she said, bridling.
I smiled to show I hadn't taken offense. I was told he was awarded a patent that earned him a lot of money. I gather before that he was considered a bit eccentric.
If he was, so what? Make your point.
I'm just thinking his fortune must have changed people's perception of you. Duncan's in particular. She was silent. Yes? No?
I suppose, she said, unwilling to commit herself.
You went from being one down to one up, where he was concerned. He sounds like the type who enjoyed a conquest to prove he could do it, if nothing else.
Are you trying to build a case for something?
I'm just trying to get a feel for what kind of guy he was.
A dead one.
Before that, you never had a fling with him?
Oh, please, don't be silly. We never had an affair.
Hey, an affair is 6 weeks or more. A fling can be anything from one night to half a dozen.
I never had a fling with him either. When did Mark leave for Vietnam? I know you married him in June. His orders came through July 26, she said, biting off the words.
The way I read the situation, Duncan was in Louisville after Mark shipped out. There you were, a young newlywed with a husband off at war. I'm sure you were lonely, needy.
This is offensive.
You're being extremely insulting, not only to me, but to Mark.
Insulting about what?
Mark said from the corridor. He shrugged out of his overcoat and tossed it over the back of a chair. He must have come in through the kitchen. His high forehead and receding hairline gave him an air of innocence. The same look babies have before they learn to bite and talk back. Laddie got up to greet him. I watched the two of them as he bussed her cheek. He said,
"Hang on a minute while I make a quick call."
He crossed to the phone and dialed 911. Laddie said,
"What's going on?"
Mark raised a finger to indicate the dispatcher had picked up.
"Hi, this is Mark Bethel. I'm at 448 Savannah Lane. I've got a couple of guys parked in a car near the entrance to my gate. Could you have a patrol car cruise by? I really don't like the looks of them." "Thanks. I'd appreciate that."
He replaced the handset and turned to Laddie and me with a shake of his head.
"Probably harmless, a lover's tryst. But just on the off chance they're casing the place."
He rubbed his palms together.
"I could use a glass of wine."
I tried to picture Detective Klass and Aldo busted by the local cops on a morals charge. Laddie poured Chardonnay in a glass, holding it by the stem so as not to smudge the bowl. The trembling of her hand caused the wine to wobble in the glass. Mark didn't seem to notice. He took the glass and sat down, giving me his full attention.
"I hope I didn't interrupt."
"We were talking about Benny Quintero," Laddie said. "She's just back from Louisville, where she did some research."
"Benny, poor guy,"
I said. "I didn't realize you were all from the same town."
"Well, that's not strictly true. I was born in Dayton, Ohio. My family moved to Louisville when I was 6. I lived there till I went off to U of K."
"And you knew Benny then?"
"I knew of him, just as he must have known about me from football games."
"I didn't realize you played football."
"More or less," he said ruefully. "I went to Atherton, which was all girls for years. School didn't go co-ed until 1954. Even then, we seldom won a game against manual or male. Mostly the players knew each other by reputation. I remember there was a guy named Bike Snell at Eastern."
"So Benny came to California and looked you up," I said.
"Right. He must have heard I was a lawyer and somehow got it in his head I could help him with his VA benefits. I mean, it's like I told him, just because I'm an attorney doesn't make me an expert. In those days, I knew next to nothing about the VA. Now, of course, I'm educating myself on the issues because I can see what a difference I can make," I said.
"Sounds like a campaign speech."
Mark smiled.
"Sorry. At any rate, I couldn't seem to convince Benny of my ignorance. The whole thing was ludicrous, but I couldn't get him off it. The guy started stalking me, appeared at the office, appeared at the house. The phone started ringing at all hours of the night. Laddie was getting nervous, and I couldn't blame her. That's when I asked Mickey to step in and see what he could do.
Meaning what? I could see him hesitate.
Well, you know, Mickey was a tough guy. I thought he could put the fear of God in him. I'm not saying Mickey meant to hurt him, but he did make threats.
When?
During the incident in the honky-tonk parking lot.
You talked to Benny after that?
Sure. He called me and he was furious. I said I'd talk to Mickey. I made a few calls, but never managed to track him down, as you know.
Because he and Dixie were together, I said, helping him along.
So they claimed. Frankly, I've always wondered. Seemed pretty damn convenient under the circumstances.
So you're saying Mickey went back to Benny and beat the shit out of him?
I'm saying it's possible. Mickey always had a temper. He hated it when some punk got the best of him.
I hardly think Benny got the best of him. Shaq says it was a shoving match with no blows exchanged.
Well, that's true. Actually, I heard the same report from the other witnesses. The point is, Mickey came off looking bad, and for a guy like him, that's worse.
You know, this is the second time you've implicated Mickey.
Hey, I'm sorry, but you asked.
Why didn't you ever mention you knew Benny back in high school?
When did I have the chance? In those days, you barely spoke to me. And since then, believe me, I've been acutely aware you're not a fan. We run into each other in public, you practically duck and hide, you're so anxious to avoid contact. Anyway, that aside, you weren't speaking to Mickey either, or he'd have told you the same thing.
I felt myself color at his accuracy, and here I thought I was so subtle. Can I ask you one more thing?
What's that?
Mark took a sip of his drink. After you joined the army, you were sent to Vietnam, is that correct?
Absolutely. I'm proud of my service record.
I'm sure you are, I said. Benny Quintero was there, and so was Duncan Oaks. I went on, giving him a hasty summation of what I'd learned from Porter Yount. Mark's face took on the look of a man who's trying to pay attention while his mind is somewhere else. I could tell he was thinking hard, composing his response before I'd finished what I was saying. His resulting smile held an element of puzzlement.
You have to understand there were hundreds of guys who fought at Ia Drang. The 1-5, the 1-7, the 2-7, the 2nd Battalion, 19th Artillery, the 227th Assault Helicopter Battalion, the 8th Engineer Battalion.
Got it, I said. There were lots of guys. I got that, but Duncan was a journalist, and he went out there specifically to talk to you because of the series he was writing. He must have told you he talked to Laddie. My guess is you felt threatened by him for years. He and Laddie were tight. She was poor in those days and never good enough for him. But I'll bet her classmates would tell me she'd had a crush on him, that she'd have given her eye teeth for his attention.
That's absurd. That's ridiculous, Laddie interjected.
Mark made a motion with his hand that told her to hush, the sort of command you teach a dog in obedience training. She closed her mouth, but the significance of the gesture wasn't lost on her. Mark was clearly annoyed.
Let's get to the bottom line. What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting the three of you connected up. You and Benny and Duncan Oaks. Mark was shaking his head.
No, wrong.
I said, yes, right. I have a snapshot of the two of them, and you're visible in the background. Laddie said,
so what?
I'll take care of this, he said to her, and then to me. Go on. This is fascinating. Clearly you've cooked up some theory and you're trying to make the pieces fit.
I know how they fit. Duncan interviewed Laddie for the paper after you shipped out. By then, her daddy had money and Duncan couldn't resist. After all, a conquest is a conquest, however late it comes. The two had a fling and you found out about it. Either she fessed up or he told you himself. Laddie said,
I don't want to talk about this. It's over and done. I made a mistake, but it was years ago.
Yeah, and I know who paid, I said caustically. Laddie, for God's sake, would you shut your mouth?
He turned back to me again, his face dark.
And?
And you killed him. Benny Quintero saw it, and that's why he was hounding you. You set Mickey up. You killed Benny, and you saw that Mickey took the rap for it.
Mark's tone was light, but it wasn't sincere.
And you're saying what? That I shot Mickey too?
Yes. He held his hands out, baffled.
Why would I do that?
Because he'd put it together the same way I have.
Wait a minute. Kinsey, Duncan's body was never found, so for all you know, he's alive and well. You think you can make a charge like this without evidence?
I have the snapshot. That helps.
Oh, that's right. The snapshot. I think I better call your bluff on that. You have it with you?
No. I left it with a friend. Mark snapped his fingers.
Oh, I forgot about Benny's brother. What's his name again? Duffy? Carlin Duffy? Now there's a bright guy for you.
I said nothing. He went on.
My sources tell me he's living in a shack at Heim's nursery. With his criminal history, it should be easy enough to put the screws to him.
I thought you weren't worried.
Call it cleanup, he said.
Really? Now that you're running for public office, you have to bury your misdeeds. Make sure the past won't rise up and bite you in the butt when you're least expecting it. He pointed at me.
Bingo!
Did you hate him that much?
Duncan? I'll tell you what pissed me off about that guy. Not so much that he screwed Laddie the minute my back was turned, but he showed up at Iadrang trying to pass himself off as a grunt. I had buddies, good friends, young guys who died with valor, brave men who believed in what we were doing. I saw them die in agony, maimed and mutilated, limbs gone, eyes shot out. Duncan Oakes was a sleaze. He had money and pretensions, but not an ounce of decency. He deserved to die, and I was happy to help him out. Speaking of which, I'd like to have his personal effects.
Effects?
Press pass. His dog tags.
I can't help you there. You'd have to talk to Duffy about those things. From the depths of my shoulder bag, there was a small but distinct click as the tape ran out and the recorder shut itself. Mark's gaze flicked down and then flicked up to my face. His smile faded, and I heard Laddie's sharp intake of breath. He held his hand out.
You want to give me that?
Hey, Dad!
The three of us turned in unison. The Bethel son, Malcolm, was standing in the door to the dining room.
What is it?
Mark said, trying not to sound impatient with the kid.
Can I take your Mercedes? I've got a date.
Of course.
Malcolm continued to stand there.
I need the keys.
Well, get a move on. We're in the middle of a conversation,
Mark said, waving him into the room. Malcolm shot me a look of embarrassment as he entered the room. Impatiently, Mark removed his keys from his pocket, twisting the key from the ring as he separated it from the others. Meanwhile, I was staring at the kid. I wonder the photographs of Duncan Oakes had seemed familiar. I'd seen him, or the incarnation of him, in Laddie's son. The same youth, the same dark, distinctly handsome looks. Malcolm at 20 was the perfect blend of Duncan at 17 and Duncan at 23. I turned to Laddie, who must have known the final piece of the puzzle had fallen into place. She said, Mark. He glanced at her, and the two exchanged a quick piece of nonverbal communication.
Where are you off to, Malcolm?
I said, ever the chipper one.
I'm taking my girlfriend to a kegger out on campus.
Great. I'm just leaving. I think I'll follow you out. I nearly got lost coming in. Could you steer me in the right direction?
Sure. No problem. I'll be happy to, he said.
I kept a careful eye on the rear of Mark Bethel's black Mercedes as Malcolm drove slowly down the driveway ahead of me. In my rearview mirror, I saw another set of headlights come into view. Mark had apparently made a scramble for Laddie's BMW, a sporty red model perfect for a hit-and-run or a high-speed chase. Malcolm had just reached the gates, triggering the automatic mechanism buried in the drive. The gates opened in front of him. Out on the road, I spotted two Santa Teresa Sheriff's Department cars pulled onto the berm, lights flashing. Three deputies were in conversation with Detectives Class and Aldo, who were just in the process of identifying themselves. Malcolm turned left onto Savannah. I followed in his wake. Detective Aldo caught my eye, but there was no way he could help until the deputies had finished with them. So much for Plan A. I checked the rearview mirror. Mark was so close on my tail, I could see the smirk on his face. I hugged the Mercedes back end, figuring Mark wouldn't ram me or shoot as long as Malcolm was close by. Maybe I'd accompany Malcolm and his girlfriend to the kegger out on campus, have a beer, shoot the shit, anything to avoid Mark. We passed a cemetery on the left and slowed at the intersection by the bird refuge. Malcolm tapped his horn and gave a final wave, turning left on Cabana while I turned right and headed for the freeway. I took the 101 north, keeping my speed at a steady 60 miles per hour. I could see Mark keeping pace. Traffic was light, not a cop on the road. I groped through my bag, fumbling among the contents with one hand while I steered with the other. I popped the tape out, leaned over and opened the glove compartment, tossed the tape in, and then closed it. I pulled a fresh cassette from the packet on the passenger seat and inserted it in the tape recorder. I didn't have my gun. I'm a private investigator, not a vigilante. Most of my work takes place in the public library or the Hall of Records. Generally speaking, these places aren't dangerous, and I seldom need a semi-automatic to protect myself. Oh, now what? I had, of course, invented the bit about Mark's being in the snapshot, visible as a backdrop to Duncan and Benny's reunion. If such a picture existed, it certainly wasn't in my hands, or Duffy's, for that matter. I winced. The very notion had put Mark on a tear, thinking we had evidence of their association. Big damn deal. Even if we had such a picture, what would that prove? I should have kept my mouth shut. Poor Duffy didn't have a clue what misery was bearing down on him. The last time I'd seen him, he was drunk as a coot, passed out on his cot. I took the Peterson off-ramp and turned left at the light. I didn't bother to speed up or make any tricky moves. Mark didn't seem to be in any hurry either. He knew where I was going, and if I went somewhere else, he'd go to Himes anyway. I think he liked the idea of this slow-paced pursuit, catching up at his leisure while I was frantically casting about for help. I turned right onto the side street and right again into the nursery parking lot. Mine was the only car. The garden center was closed. The building's interior was dim except for a light here and there to discourage the odd burglar with a green thumb or an urge for potted plants. The rest of the acreage was blanketed in darkness. I parked, locked the car, and headed off on foot. I confess I ran, having given up all pretense of being casual about these things. Glancing back, I could see the headlights of the Beamer as it eased into the lot. I was waiting for the sound of the car door slamming, but Mark had bumped his way across the low concrete barrier, and he was driving down the wide lanes between crated trees. I cut back and forth, holding my shoulder bag against me to keep it from jostling as I picked up my pace. Idly, I realized the maze of box trees had somehow shifted. Lanes I remembered from earlier were gone or rotated on an axis, now shooting off on parallel routes. I wasn't sure if trees had been added, subtracted, or simply rearranged. Maybe Himes had a landscape project that required a half-grown arbor. I yelled Duffy's name, hoping to alert him in advance of my arrival, but the sound seemed to be absorbed by the portable forest surrounding me. Mark was still barreling along behind me, but at least the narrow twists and turns were slowing him down. I felt like I was stoned. Everything moved at half speed, including me. I reached the maintenance shed, heart thumping, breath ragged. The yellow forklift was blocking the lane, parked beside the shed with a crated 15-foot tree hoisted on the forks ready to be moved. The shed door was open and a pale light spilled out onto the path like water. Duffy! I called. The lights were on in his makeshift tent, but there was no sign of him. His shoes were missing, and the blanket I'd laid over him was now crumpled on the floor. A cheap saucepan sat on the hot plate filled with a beige sludge that looked like refried beans. A plastic packet of flour tortillas sat unopened on the unused burner. The pan still felt warm, so maybe he'd stepped out to take a leak. I heard the BMW skidding to a halt. Duffy! I checked the top of the orange crate. Duncan Oakes's press pass, his dog tags, and the snapshot were still lying where I'd left them. Outside, I heard the car door slam, the sound of someone thumping in my direction. I gathered Duncan's things in haste, looking for a place to hide them before Bethel appeared. Quickly, I considered and discarded the idea of hiding the items in Duffy's clothes. The shed itself was crude, with little in the way of furniture and no nooks or crannies. In the absence of insulation, I was looking at bare studs, not so much as a toolbox where I could stash the stuff. I shoved the items in my back pocket just as Mark appeared in the doorway, a gun in his hand. "Oh, shit," I said. "I'd appreciate your handing me the tape recorder and tape." "No problem," I said. I reached in my shoulder bag, took out the tape recorder, and held it out to him. While I watched, he tucked the tape recorder up against his body, pressed the eject button with his free hand, and extracted the cassette. He dropped the tape recorder on the dirt floor and crushed it with his foot. Behind him, I caught a flicker of movement. Duffy appeared in the doorway and then eased back out of sight. "I don't get it," I said. I focused on Mark, making sure I didn't telegraph Duffy's presence with my eyes.
"Get what?"
Mark was distracted. He tried to keep his eyes pinned on me while he held the gun and cassette in one hand and unraveled the tape with the other, pulling off the reel. Loops of thin, shiny ribbon were tangled in his fingers, trailing to the floor in places. "I don't understand what you're so worried about. There's nothing on there that would incriminate you."
"I can't be sure what Laddie said before I showed."
"She was the soul of discretion," I said dryly. Mark smiled in spite of himself.
"What a champ."
"Why did you kill Benny?"
"To get him off my back. What do you think?"
"Because he knew you killed Duncan."
"Because he saw me do it."
"Just like that?"
"Just like that. Call it a flash of inspiration. Six of us were loaded with the body bags. Duncan was pissing and moaning, but I could tell he wasn't hurt bad. Fucking baby. Before we could lift off, the medic was killed by machine gun fire. Benny seemed to be out of it. I'd been shot in the leg and I'd taken a load of shrapnel in my back and side. Up we went. I remember the chopper shuddering, and I didn't think we'd make it under all the small arms fire. The minute we were airborne, I crawled over to Duncan, stripped him of his ID, ripped the tags off his neck, and tossed him aside. All the time, the chopper was lurching and vibrating like a crazy man shaking it back and forth. Duncan lay there looking at me, but I don't think he fully understood what I was doing until I hoisted him out. Benny saw me, the shit. He pretended he'd passed out, but he saw the whole deal. By then, I was lightheaded and rolled over on my side, sick with sweat. That's when Benny took the tags and hit him.
I take it he pressed you too hard.
Hey, I did what I could for him. He should have left well enough alone. In the end, I killed him as much for being dumb as trying to screw me over.
And Mickey?
That schmuck. The less said about him, the better. Let's cut the chit-chat and get on with this.
He snapped his fingers, pointing to the bag. I don't have a weapon.
It's Duncan's tags I want.
I left the stuff sitting on the orange crate. Duffy must have taken it. Mark snapped his fingers, gesturing for me to give him the bag. I lied about the snapshot.
Give me the fucking bag!
I passed him my shoulder bag and watched while he searched. His holding the gun necessitated his working with the bag clamped against his chest. This made it tricky to inspect the interior while he kept an eye on me. Impatiently, he tipped the bag upside down, dumping out the contents. Somewhere nearby, I heard the low rumble of heavy equipment, and I found myself praying, please, please, please. Mark heard it too. He tossed the bag to one side and motioned with the gun, indicating I should leave before him. I was suddenly afraid. While we talked, while we stood face to face, I didn't believe he'd kill me, because I didn't think he'd have the nerve. My own fate had seemed curiously out of my hands. What mattered at that point was knowing the truth, finding out what happened to Duncan and Benny and Mick. Now the act of turning my back was almost more than I could bear. I moved toward the door. I could hear the deep growl of a diesel motor, some piece of machinery picking up speed as it advanced. My skin felt radiant. Anxiety snaked through my gut like summer lightning. I yearned to see what Mark was doing, I wondered if the gun was pointed at my back, wondered if he was, even then, in the process of releasing the safety, tightening his index finger on the trigger, speeding me to my death. Most of all, I wondered if the bullet would hit me before I heard the sound of the shot. I heard the crack of sudden impact and glanced back, watching with astonishment as the shed wall blew in, boards splintering on contact as the tractor plowed through. Duffy's cot was crushed under the rolling track, which seemed to have the weight and destructive power of a moving tank. The front-mounted bucket banged into the space heater and sent it flying in my direction. I ducked my head, but the heater caught me in the back with an impetus that knocked me to my knees. As I scrambled to my feet, I looked over my shoulder. The entire rear wall of the shed had been demolished. Duffy threw the tractor in reverse and backed out of the flattened structure, doing a 3-point turn. I ran, emerging from the shed in time to see Mark jump into the BMW and jam the key into the ignition. The engine ground ineffectually, but never coughed to life. Duffy, in the tractor, bore down on the vehicle. From the grin on his face, I had to guess he'd disabled the engine. Mark took aim and fired at Duffy, perched high in the tractor cab. I was caught between the two men, and I paused, mesmerized by the violence unfolding. My heart burned in my chest, and the urge to run was almost overpowering. I could see that Mark was corralled in the cul-de-sac formed by the wreckage of the shed, a row of crated trees, and the tractor, which was picking up speed again as Duffy accelerated. I was blocking his only avenue of escape. Mark started running in my direction, apparently hoping to blow by me in his bid for freedom. He fired at Duffy again, and the bullet zinged off the cab with a musical note. Duffy worked the lever that controlled the lift arm as the tractor bore down on him. I started running at Mark. He veered off at the last minute, reversing himself. He jumped up on one of the crates, hoping to crash through the trees to the aisle just behind. I caught him in midair and shoved him. He bungled a leap, toppled backward, and fell on me. We went down in a heap. As he scuttled to his feet, I reached out and snagged his ankle, holding on for dear life. He staggered, half dragging me into Duffy's path. Duffy stomped on the accelerator. I released Mark and rolled sideways. The tractor lurched forward, diesel engine rumbling, the bucket lever screeching as Duffy maneuvered it. Mark pivoted, trying to launch himself in the opposite direction, but Duffy bore down on him, the bucket extended like a cradle. Mark turned to face the tractor, gauging its momentum in hopes of dodging its mass. He fired another round, but it clanged harmlessly off the bucket. He had badly misjudged Duffy's skill. The metal lip banged into Mark's chest with an impact that nearly lifted him off his feet, driving him back against the side wall of the shed. For a moment, he hung there, pinned between the bucket and the wall. He struggled, his weight pulling him down until the lip of the bucket rested against his throat. Duffy looked over at me, and I could see his expression soften. He propelled the tractor forward, and Mark's neatly severed head thumped into the bucket like a cantaloupe. It wasn't quite Plan B, but it would have to do. Epilogue. The bust at the honky-tonk didn't come down for another 6 months. A federal grand jury returned a 15-count indictment against Tim Littenberg and a 12-count indictment against Scott Shackelford for manufacturing counterfeit credit cards, which carries a minimum 5-year prison term and a $250,000 fine for each conviction. Both are currently free on bail. Carlin Duffy was arrested and charged with voluntary manslaughter, and he's awaiting trial in the Santa Teresa County Jail, with its volleyball, indoor toilets, and color television sets. Mickey died on June 1st. I sat with him, my gaze fixed on the monitor above his bed. I watched the staggered line of his beating heart, strong and steady, though his color began to fade and his breathing became more labored as the days went by. I touched his face, feeling the cool flesh that would never be warm again. After the rapture of love comes the wreckage, at least in my experience. I thought of all the things he'd taught me, the things we'd been to one another during that brief marriage. My life was richer for his having been part of it. Whatever his flaws, whatever his failings, his redemption was something he'd earned in the end. I laid my cheek against his hand and breathed with him until the last breath. "You done good, kid," I whispered, when he was still at last. Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone.
Another unabridged title by Sue Grafton, available on audio from Random House, is N is for News, read by Mary Pfeiffer. This has been a Random House audio books presentation. Production copyright 1999, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.